Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
The cultural blind spot, a simple phrase often said in jest to pardon our own admitted pop culture oversights, omissions, and outright rejections. Among even aficionados, there hangs in the air a pantheon of books and albums, films and artists deemed by the vocal majority to be unmissable, but that we just can't make ourselves embrace. Indeed, plenty of us sailed right past those pillars of pop culture, those works of modern consciousness, either in defiance or in boredom, or found beloved works of our own that never quite gained footing in the mainstream, or those that were snubbed by those we called our tastemakers. Littered in there somewhere are a million pithy arguments that fall into this bucket of cultural blind spots. As a teenager, I delighted in the raw, ragged, and writhing emotion pressed against my mind when I read Sylvia Plath's Bell Jar. Wuthering Heights, though, not the deep, gothic tale I wanted. And so it sat in my high school backpack, on my nightstand, and in moving box after moving box until I gave up, despite countless professors and colleagues extolling its virtues. And who sets up that pantheon of must-listen, must-watch, must-read work anyway? As such, couldn't we also imagine that the classics and staples don't actually apply evenly to everyone? Or do they? Think of the universally revered novels or movies or albums that do nothing for you. Maybe you don't get it, or you never saw it and you don't care to, or read it, or hear it, or whatever. Either way, that's the idea for this evening's discussion. We have a great, great group of esteemed guests tonight. We have Pat McDonald, who is a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and FilmAutonomy.com. We have a high school literature teacher, Craig Kingston, and Tim Tuttle, the man behind the legendarily cool Chicago music venue, The Hideout. I'm Amy Guth. Rachel Woodall will be the very kind voice at the other end of the line when you call us tonight at 312-981-7200 to confess cultural blind spots of your own or to share comments throughout the show. It's time for the Saturday Night Special on WGN. This evening's episode, Cultural Blind Spots.
I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm gonna make them an offer he can't refuse.
720 WGN. It's the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight. Tonight, we're talking all about cultural blind spots. It is all about the movies, the books, the bands, the albums, the songs, all of those things that so many people just love, 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 but you just cannot get it. You're not on board. You're not feeling it. Or the things that you super, super, super love and you don't understand why everyone else does not do the same. We're talking all about those things, and we're going to look at some of the narratives around that and how maybe that's changed over time. So to help me do that, we have a very esteemed panel of guests with us this evening that I'm very, very happy to introduce. We have Craig Kingston, who is a literature teacher and theater director at Crystal Lake Central High School. He's with us. I'm going to turn on his microphone. We also have Pat McDonald, who's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and Film Autonomy. Film Autonomy.com, and Tim Tutton, who is owner at The Hideout. So welcome to the program, everybody. All of your microphones are on so we can all just talk and be friends here. But I want to open this up. Let's walk our talk a little bit. What are the blind spots that you have that you would like to unburden yourself of? Or maybe it's those things that you just love that just never, you don't get a lot of love for them in return. I would say my favorite band, I love The Smiths so much, but so many people are like, no, it's a downer. No, it's not a downer. It's fun. It's cheeky and merry. And I get that one a lot. I get that a lot, but I'm always extolling the virtues of The Smiths. So what about you guys? Pat, why don't you start?
Well, I just want to say that Tim is the coolest guy here first as the owner of The Hideout.
That's weird. That's a first. Thank you. Is that a high school teacher that said that?
No, that was a film critic.
Oh, the film. Yeah, okay.
Much better judge of character.
Well, the first thing I want to say, and I want to quote the great Roger Ebert, and he always said, you can't see everything.
Right.
And so there are so many gaping holes I feel sometimes in my film education, even though I've been studying it now for years.
Blankety-blank years.
And, you know, when you start to talk about genres, and that's what it, when it gets interesting, because you can talk about, like, for example, 1930 studio films from 1930 to 1940. We all know, like, the golden age of 1939 and forward, where you know, some of these great films are self-evident. But from, like, about right after the sound era, about 1930 all the way to about 1939, there's a big gap there that, you know, that not a lot of people see unless they're freakishly following Turner Classic Movies all the time, which to me, Turner Classic Movies is the little piece of bait that is dangled in front of me every single day. I will literally go through the film lineup for the day and say, didn't see it, didn't see it, didn't see it.
Saw it, didn't see it.
You know, I think when you're studying something very expansive, such as literature or film, there's always going to be gaps there. Mm-hmm. And when
is
you
there one that you really kick yourself for that you're like, gosh, I don't know why I've never seen that. I just never got around to it.
Yes, the Apu trilogy, the Sanyat Ray's Apu trilogy, supposed to be the greatest piece of cinema out of India ever made. And I've had several opportunities to see it. They show it quite often in Chicago, especially at the Gene Siskel Center. Mm-hmm. And I still haven't had an opportunity to come upon that yet. And it's great to come on and trash my credibility. Thank you, Amy.
I'm here to help.
Thank you.
Craig, what about you? What are the things that are just not on your radar, or the things you think should be on everybody's radar?
Well, one of the things that I struggle with as a teacher, I teach AP literature. At the same time, I'm also teaching freshmen struggling readers. So with the struggling readers, you really got to try to keep them engaged. A lot of the newer young adult fiction is, so I'm trying to read that. At the same time, go back to the old works. Actually, the one thing that I feel real guilty about never reading, and this one I think I might even be putting my job on the line, is it's a classic, the To Kill a Mockingbird.
Wow.
I was never asked to read it in school. I never read it in college. And then I saw the movie. It's a great one of those. It was one of those good movies that I think transitions well from book to film. But yeah. And then I was never asked to teach it. And so I saw it so many times. And then I watched I've seen a couple of live productions of the play, so I just never went back and read it. I feel really bad. That's one of the standard lit options for, I think, our freshmen. So
sure.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. I bet a bunch of students just, you know, heard that.
Yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
I'm going to give him so much grief about that. Tim, what about you? What are the blind spots in your world?
Well, I'll say that by you mentioning the Smiths right off the bat, that really resonates with me. I'm born and raised in Chicago, and after I got out of college in 1984, I just had to get out of here. I could not stand Chicago. I hated Chicago. I did not know why I lived in this Midwestern city. And so I went to Europe, like a lot of people did, got my Let's Go book before the computers and internet and all that, and I went straight to London. And it was 1984, and between, I would say, 1979 while I was in college and 1984, I decided that rock and roll was dead and that everything about rock and roll was horrible. I liked punk music. I liked Southern rock music. I liked progressive rock. I liked Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. I also liked Elvis Costello and The Clash. And yet I just was thinking that, well, The Clash is replicating rockabilly music and Elvis Costello is doing Motown pop music with Get Happy. And I just kept thinking, like, it's all, they're just rehashing what has already been done. And then I got to London. It was 1984 and Meat Is Murder came out. And I really realized that rock isn't dead. That Meat Is Murder, that Ring Around the Fountain, This Charming Man. And I hate to say it because here in Chicago now, I'm a complete and total unbelievable Chicago cheerleader, and I really celebrate everything Chicago, Curtis Mayfield, Wilco, Mavis Staples. But I had to go to Europe. I had to hear the Smiths. I had to hear Billy Bragg. I had to be part of a time where there was this punk rock and this just amazing Manchester sensibility, and see how the people in Manchester were just reacting to the fact that there was a band that was coming out of their town. And people then, while I was over there, were saying things like, "You're from Chicago? Oh my God, you guys are the house. You're Muddy Waters. You're Willie Dixon. Wow. You are Buddy Guy. You are Mavis Staples. You're the Staples Singers." And what I realized is that in what I was just all the time, and I spent 9 months just wandering throughout Europe, typical post-college, middle-class kid, and everywhere I went, from Germany to Czechoslovakia to Hungary, people talked about the jazz scene in Chicago. They asked me about the blues scene in Chicago. They asked me about rock bands in Chicago. But the thing that brings me back to the Smiths is that the Smiths were a contemporary band that took music, and they took a history of music, and they made it of its time and of contemporary, and they injected it with energy. And when people say, "Oh, you're so maudlin because mm-hmm. of Morrissey and everything like that," I just really related to the fact that the Smiths were not from London. Right. They were, you know, from Manchester, and they were like the second city of England. And I felt like this is exactly how I feel. To hell with the Sex Pistols, and right. the hell with like these London bands. They're the cool New York style people, right? But back in Chicago, it's a little bit different, and we're a little bit more depressed, and yet we're a little bit more empathetic and sensitive. Yeah. And so actually the Smiths brought me back to rock and roll. And I'm not just saying that because you just said that.
I love that story.
But it's crazy that you said that. And so it's like the Smiths made me realize, okay, here's Manchester, Madchester, yeah. you know, and they're having a scene up there. And I thought, well, Chicago, what, you know, I am from a stupid industrial Midlands town like Manchester. And that stupid industrial Midwestern town actually is the town where people like Frank Lloyd Wright meets Van der Rohe, where the we have a thing that's happening here,
yeah.
you know? And that was happening with Big Black, and that was happening with Steve Albini, and that was happening with Waz Moniz, or, you know, Naked Ray Gun. And it made me realize, and it's that silly, stupid thing where you have to leave Chicago and look back from another place like Europe, and then realize that, you know, they look at us with a sort of this unbelievable reverence, mm-hmm. you know? And so, anyway, so what's the blank spot? Wait, what's the question?
I love the Smith story. That's so good.
Yeah.
I love that. I have a feeling I'll be retelling that story many times and pointing people to this podcast so they can hear it too.
Yeah.
I think that story stands on its own, really. But you bring up an interesting point, though, too. I think about kind of the sense of pride of place when we yeah. see our place depicted somewhere, how it can kind of romanticize it. You know, on this show, we yeah. A couple times a year, we talk about books and Chicago books in particular. And last time we did that show, we were talking about the great Chicago novel mm-hmm. and how that narrative can be a lot of things, depending on who you're asking. That can be Nelson Algren, but mm-hmm. can also be Gwendolyn Brooks. There can be a lot, you know, that can be a lot of different things, depending on who you ask and what their experience, kind of their lens through which they have seen the city. Do you feel like there's that kind of place, particularly in movies? There's so many movies that have been shot in Chicago.
Yes.
Sometimes to our entertainment, right? Because you're like, that neighborhood is nowhere near that neighborhood they were in a second ago, right?
Right.
Sometimes it's kind of silly, but sometimes I think they do it pretty well. Sometimes it kind of makes us cringe. Sometimes it's supposed to be somewhere else, but they're shooting here and we know it, right?
Well, I do a film tour of Chicago, so I'm pretty much an expert. And Tim, I want to say you did prove your coolness, absolutely.
But I don't know where that's coming from at all.
It's coming from that last descriptive thing there, Madchester okay. man. What I noticed from out of towners, and I'll tell you, Londoners and Aussies just love Chicago.
Yeah.
They love Chicago. They love to come and indulge in the culture of film here. because, you know, film is a mass medium. Everybody sees it. Everybody around the world knows Ferris Bueller and Jake and Elwood Blues, and they want to come and see the city where they were born. Mm-hmm. And it is cool. I mean, some of the locations I've found over the years have just been extraordinary as far as giving you a sense of, you know, what occurs in the film or where it takes place or that sort of thing. So Chicago, I think, has had a tremendous, tremendous contribution to the film culture and a verifiable stamp on that culture. Mm-hmm. So.
In such a way that I think it's interesting how it makes news when, you know, Cameron's house from Ferris Bueller goes on the market.
Right.
Things like that. You know, the house from Home Alone is for sale again. Things like that. That yeah. We really, you know, kind of treasure those things. Or people, when you ask them, people that are from here, where did you grow up? Down the street from the house from 16 Candles. Things like that. They give you those markers in, you know, cultural shared memory as a marker of a thing in a place we can all kind of identify
Absolutely.
With.
Absolutely.
We're talking about cultural blind spots. The movies, the music, the books, all of those things that maybe we didn't connect with quite the way we think we should have because of the main narrative, or maybe things that we've really deeply connected with and we feel like maybe the rest of the world hasn't so much. We're talking all about those tonight. So give us a call, 312-981-7200. We would love for you to confess your cultural blind spots as well here on 720 WGN. We'll take a quick break and be back in just a bit.
Every now and then, say what the f***. What the f*** gives you freedom? Freedom brings opportunity. Opportunity makes your future.
Kyle, be right there.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. We are talking all about cultural blind spots tonight, and that is the books, the music, the movies, all of those things we hate to admit that we have never seen. But also some of the things that we love so much that maybe the rest of the world does not quite love as much as we do. We're talking about all those things. If you would like to confess a book you've not read but feel like you should, maybe you're embarrassed to admit it, a movie you haven't seen, an album you just don't get, something like that, give us a call, 312-981-7200, and you are free to confess your sins on air, and we won't mock you too much. It'll be all good. All friends here. All right, so we're hanging out with my very, very esteemed guests here. We have Tom Tutton, who's the owner of The Hideout. We have Pat McDonald, who's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and FilmAutonomy.com, and Craig Kingston, who's a literature teacher and theater director at Crystal Lake Central High School. So we have many wonderful points of view represented here in the studio tonight on our discussion. But right before the break, we were talking about music, and I want to keep with that a bit longer. And you know, I think we can sort of simultaneously focus on two competing narratives here, and that is, and maybe they're not even that competing, but it seems like just in the world at large, there are some bands and artists that you see, even if you're not necessarily a fan, right? There's that you may not be a big Madonna fan, but it's one of those, if someone offers you tickets, you go, yeah, I want to say that I've seen Madonna or something like that. I think a lot of people just in the last couple of weeks have been saying that about Prince, of like, I didn't really get him until I saw him live, and I just sort of went to see him. And then I left a big fan because he, you know, put on this great show. But I think there are some of those in the micro, too. There are some of those in our own backyard of people that maybe are a little bit, not unsung, but that everybody, even if you're not a fan, you recognize their glory and their power, and you recognize they're somebody that represents Chicago and is kind of part of that. Tim, I'll start with you. Who comes to mind when you think of that for the Chicago part of that equation?
Someone from Chicago that I don't get.
Or maybe not necessarily that you don't get, but one of those that, like, everybody should go see them, whether or not they're a fan, just because they are powerful or because they have lasting power or some kind of iconic something to them. Or maybe it's someone who's already, you know, already quite famous that is from Chicago that we kind of claim even if we're not a fan of necessarily.
When I think of Chicago, the first performer I think of is Mavis Staples all the time. And I think about her because, I mean, she has performed at The Hideout. That has nothing to do with anything. That was like some kind of thing from God or something that she came to The Hideout. But Mavis Staples and her sister and brother, Purvis, and her family, they live here. They live in Chicago. They perform around Chicago, okay? And so when we think of things in America, Aretha Franklin, or when we think of the greatest of the greats, the Staples Singers were there with Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. They were there before Martin Luther King. They came up in the 1950s. Mavis Staples went to Chicago Public Schools along with all of her sisters and brothers. They represent to me everything that is unbelievable. And when you hear her, she is a person. Speaking of Prince, she recorded an album with Prince. Yeah. Prince called her and said, would you please do a solo album? I want to do this with you. And so she's recorded with Jeff Tweedy. I mean, she is this person that from the 1950s as a teenager, think of Beyonce, who mm-hmm. was a teenager, you know, with Destiny's Child. So Mavis has been around since a teenager, through her 20s, through Watts Stax, through the Martin Luther King, the march to Birmingham, yeah. you know, from Selma. She has been there in every single thing that has happened in our history for the last 60 years, 70 years. And this is a woman who will go to a bar like The Hideout and sing a song. And she will play A Taste of Chicago. And so I think that she is unbelievable. She is an international powerhouse, and she never ever acts like that. She's like, she made that album, those albums with Jeff Tweedy. Mm-hmm. She made a most recent album. So Mavis Staples comes to mind. The other person that comes to my mind a lot lately is Renee Fleming from the Lyric Opera. Okay, mm-hmm. Renee Fleming comes to this city, and she comes to the Lyric Opera, and right away, the first thing she says is, I want everybody to realize that opera is accessible, mm-hmm. it's diverse, it's multicultural, it's working people's music. And from the very beginning, she has a program called Chicago Voices. And she has been reaching out to high schools and to kids. She's been connecting with hip-hop singers and all these different, you know, folks. She came by the Hideout. That's crazy. And Renee Fleming is like the Kennedy Center
yeah.
Presidential Medal of Freedom type person. And Renee Fleming is the most down-to-earth person. And so here are two women. And I think that's symbolic because Chicago is about strength. It's about vocal power. It's about having music like Mavis and Renee Fleming that you don't need a microphone, that you can blast it out without electricity. You are strong enough to do it. But you're a woman, and you have this sensibility to connect, and you care, and you have an empathy. So anyway, two people that I think that Mavis Staples is an absolute United Nations level thing, and she represents our city. And Renee Fleming, this person who's at the Lyric Opera, is a person who is right down there connecting with hip-hop, connecting with young people, saying that I want to make the Lyric Opera connected with folks in the streets. Mm-hmm. I just think those are two people right now that we need to be just thankful that they are walking on the streets of Chicago.
Yeah,
and we need to celebrate them.
And there's something so great and accessible, I feel like, about the people that, you know, the celebrities that we claim as our own. I feel like mm-hmm. that we always hear about them being so accessible, right? And mm-hmm. I think we heard a lot of that about Minneapolis, about Prince, that, you know, oh, I met that guy at the hardware store and I saw him riding his bike, that he was very much a part of that community mm-hmm. in the way that, you know, you're talking about Renee Fleming being involved with a lot of different groups, doing just regular stuff and working with people that are right here in the city now. Who would you say is kind of poised to do that next of the local artists that we have right now, that are the young people that are emerging right now?
The people that are doing that right now, I mean, the obvious person is Chance the Rapper. Mm-hmm. He's all over the place. He's all about Chicago. He's for good or for better or for worse, okay? Chirac could come out. He'll be critical, okay? Mm-hmm. Even though he was offered a place there to be in it. But Chance the Rapper represents a large group of young people, which we should be so proud of. This city, our Chicago public schools have produced a group of young people that you could just look at. Chance the Rapper plays with Donnie Trumpet. Donnie Trumpet's got the Social Experiment. The Social Experiment is made up of a bunch of kids that went to Chicago public schools, all right? A lot of them went to Whitney Young High School. You've got kids like, and involved in that are people like kind of the Kids These Days kind of group that back when they were teenagers included Vic Mensa. okay, yeah. Included Liam Cunningham, included Marcy, who plays with Ohm, who plays with Seema Cunningham, okay? So there are a group of, like, kids that were teenagers that are now about 21, 22, 23 years old, and they are, like, just blowing it up all over the country. And even Spencer Tweedy with Tweedy and Liam Cunningham, who plays in that band, there's all these, like, they're like in their young 20s. We keep thinking of them as kids, but really what happened about in the last 10 years is a group of teenagers came up to the Chicago Public Schools. They met each other. They started playing in bands. Twin Peaks is part of that, all right, that you just mentioned. And these kids, they went to Chicago. They grew up in Chicago, and they are like this younger generation. And so you have this group of people that moved to Chicago from the suburbs, basically, in the 1980s and 90s. Some of them decided to stay, and they had children, and they put their children in school. Those children grew up, and some of them grew up, and now they're creating this musical scene. And the scene, like, you go from Chance to Merrill, it's to Ohm. It's hip hop. It's rap. It's folk music, it's country rock, it's alternative rock, it's like classically based rock like Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. They're covering all these different genres that they listen to their parents' album collection, but at the same time, they're creating new music. So I think it's a really exciting time right now with those guys.
I think it is too, and it seems like it would be very hard to pinpoint what Chicago sound is right now, because I feel like it's so all over the map, really.
So the great philosopher of Chicago, and another person who I think is an unheralded hero, is Rhymefest,
yeah.
Chase Smith, okay?
Yeah.
Chase Smith is the guy who won the Grammy with Kanye for Jesus Walks, and he also helped write the lyrics for the theme song for Selma,
mm-hmm.
okay, that Common performed with John Legend. So here is an example. Rhymefest is an example of a guy who, when you look at popular music in America today, and if you look at comedy, and if you look at movies, and if you look at television, all right, you will always see, where's the Chicago connection? And somewhere, if it's not on the screen or right on the vocal on the track, there is a writer right behind it, okay? So it's Hannibal Buress writing for 30 Rock, whatever. So Rhymefest is this person who is so Chicago, he runs for alderman. That's how Chicago he is, okay?
Right.
But Rhymefest has a saying, and he says, the Chicago sound, it's not about a sound, it's about a sensibility. So when you say it's all over the map, I think that's a really great term, because that means all over the map means north side, west side, south side. But what it's about, so it could be all 50 wards.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be based racially. The one thing that comes down to, it's about a sensibility. And that's what Rhymefest says. Not about a sound, it's about a sensibility. So if you have a band like Wilco, if the music is being written from them, it's original and it comes from the heart, that's real. If it's coming from the south side and it's Twista, it's Lupe, if it's Kanye, who's New York now or LA or wherever the hell he is, but Rhymefest, if it's Vic Mensa, if it's Chance the Rapper, if it's authentic and from the heart, that's the Chicago sensibility. So we do have all these genres of music, which is exciting, but it's about, where's it coming from? And that's what Chicago always wants to have. Mm-hmm. Is it real? Is it street? Is it authentic?
Yeah.
That's what makes us real.
And I think that carries through to a lot of different art forms, into books, into movies, into TV shows. That carries into so many things. We're talking all about cultural blind spots tonight here on the show. We will be right back in just a bit to continue this conversation on 720 WGN.
Grandma, mine's handmade, pan-fried, sun-dried, south-side, and beat the devil by a landslide, praying with a hands tied, president of my fan club, Santa, something told me I should bring my
you gotta move it slowly, taking in my body like it's holy, I've been waiting for you for the whole week, I've been praying for you, you're my Sunday king.
You gotta move slowly.
Little Donnie Trumpet there. Good times. 720 WGN, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. We're talking all about cultural blind spots, and that's really what I mean by that, is the movies, the music, the books, the albums, the specific songs, sometimes all those things that maybe we're a little sheepish about admitting that we just don't know quite enough about. But what's interesting is, as we are having this discussion, the what I like to call the paradox of wisdom is occurring, and that is, the more you think you know, you quickly realize the less that you know. And we're getting our horizons expanded in wonderful ways here as we're talking about. So far, we've been talking a lot about music, about a lot of interesting, really, really wonderful things happening here locally that are really rippling around the country. I have wonderful, esteemed guests here in the studio with me. Tim Tutton is here. He's the owner of The Hideout, a really, really fantastic music venue right here in Chicago. Pat McDonald, who's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and FilmAutonomy.com, and Craig Kingston, who's a lit teacher and theater director at Crystal Lake Central High School. So I've got everybody's microphone back on so we can continue this wonderful conversation. You know, so I want to talk a little bit about, we've been talking specifically about Chicago music, but I want to talk about kind of the idea. We talked about this last week on the show, but because we were talking about Prince and how unifying it is, the act of fanship and how you perform identity when you come and say, I am a fan of this artist or this, you know, movie or this book or whatever, how you bond with somebody. Because, you know, sometimes if it's a really obscure work, you go, oh my gosh, you love that movie. I love that movie. I know marriages that have started over less than right bonding over, the right book or then some obscure work or something like that. So I want to kind of talk about that a little bit, the act of being a fan of creative work. I think particularly as we're talking about music, I think that's a really interesting place, because right before the break, we were saying while the sounds might be different, the unifying factor of Chicago is really the feel and this community, kind of we're all in it together. This is like deeply community piece that across all the wards, this is a big, big community. This is a big, big neighborhood. And we're all doing these things together, even if our art sounds very different at the end of the day and at different venues, which I think is really, really interesting. So where do we see that the moments of fanship popping up, particularly in Chicago, as we're thinking about books and music and movies and things like that? Where do you see that the most, where we see fans really, uniting over, not necessarily uniting over an artist, but uniting over their love or ownership even of an artist?
I would say, if I'm going to speak for the film scene here, what is very gratifying to me is the expansion of it. And when I say expansion, it kind of goes with how these neighborhoods are emerging. When we talk about Wicker Park, or we talk about the Southport neighborhood with the Music Box and Wicker Park with the Logan, where they're becoming not only places to go and sit and watch the movie, but, you know, they're attaching bars to them. And so you can actually go into those places, you can hang out, and you can talk about your favorite films. And the Logan is more of a mainstream place where they'll show retrospects and they'll show midnight movies and that sort of thing. So I feel like it's a little younger, a little more party atmosphere there. Whereas at the Music Box, you will find more cinephiles. They show pretty intense cinematic stuff there. And then you can hang out in the bar afterward and talk about it, or just talk in general about film. So that's where I see the expansion happening. And it's part of the scene with the universities, too, as DePaul and Columbia College and all those keep bringing new filmmakers into the scene, some of them staying in the city and being part of that expansion that I talked about.
Well, you know, I think that's a really interesting point. I just drew a blank on the is it Stage 18, the film?
Yes.
The film incubator, right?
Yes.
I think that's a really interesting thing that's kind of touching all the genres we're representing here tonight, right? It used to be this flyover city that if you wanted to accomplish something artistically, you had to get yourself to one of the coasts. And so we saw these very funny comedians that would make their way through the Second City and I.O. and all of that, and then immediately go to L.A. or New York. And then we saw bands that would get out of here, and then we saw all these things that we would see writers, and then they would get the big book would start to work and they'd get out of here. We saw, you know, filmmakers that would go to LA, and I really feel like that's happening less and less now. People are really starting to stick around, and in fact I think people are starting to help give those artists reason to stick around. You know, we certainly see it in the literary world, right? With
young adult authors, I think, definitely.
Oh, definitely.
I'm thinking
of
Veronica Roth and the Divergent series, and the kids totally are picking up on that. And
John Green.
Yeah.
That is a huge thing that's happening here. The young adult authors and the are these the the John Green and Veronica Roth.
Right.
And
they're
really cool and hip ones, kind of edgy, yeah. cool ones that are very much proud of their roots here.
She based the whole stories yeah. on Chicago.
And okay. and it ties in back with the film, too. I yeah. I think the industry bringing it back here, too.
Well, that's yeah, interesting, too, that's that it seems like there's a lot of crossover, right? I mean, I know some filmmakers that are working with local bands to kind of yeah. make... make interesting projects. And I know literary writers here because there's a reading series every night in this city. There's yeah. there at least one. There's so many, and it's a very supportive community of writers. But I'm seeing a lot of straight up fiction writers starting to collaborate with, you know, bands and do live stuff on stage and live lit in really cool ways. So I think there's a lot of cool Venn diagrams happening. Rachel, what were you about to say?
Yeah. I was going to say Gillian Flynn.
Yeah,
Gone
yeah.
Girl.
Gone Girl.
Yeah.
And another
Jillian
one of her
Flynn.
Books that's actually my favorite is turning into a movie now, too. The Sharp Objects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a good one. That's a great one. Yeah. There's so many. It's really interesting how you now have people either coming back after they've, you know, made some kind of success on one of the coasts, or they're like, no, I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm going to stay. I'm going to stay right here. I'm going to keep doing my thing. So yeah. I think it's very, very interesting.
It is. I think also when you have the folks that are from Chicago and they're going to the coast, and I think of like a perfect example, male, female, east, west coast, is Hannibal Buress, mm-hmm. all right, going to New York, and then you have Cameron Esposito going to L.A., okay? So they went there. They had to go to L.A. and New York, but every moment of their every breath that they make, they like reference Chicago, and they're like, yeah, I came up to Chicago here, but I'm in Chicago. And so in a way, I think we used to think like, well, then why don't you live here, you know? But in reality, now a lot of us look at it like, no, this is a modern time where people fly everywhere, mm-hmm. and lots of couples, one lives in one city, one lives in another, and it's almost like the folks that come up and out of Chicago, they represent all the time. So there, it's like you don't have to actually physically live here, but we do want you to reference us in yeah. your material or something. And they're doing that. They're proud of it.
Yeah, you see it in really mainstream ways too, like in 30 Rock. I feel like that came yeah. up all the time. Yeah. I think Tina Fey was right. always talking about back in Chicago, and you know, she and
Jane Krakowski.
There we go. There, thank you. They're always talking about when they worked together in Chicago.
They would do flashbacks
all
to
the
Second
time.
City
all the time, which is really great. There's so many ways to represent without being physically here.
It's kind of a weird Chicago Second City thing that we have, is that whenever we see somebody who came up from Chicago, we like are waiting for them to say, okay, come on, what about us? Don't forget us, you know? And it's that like thing, like in New York, they don't do that probably. No. And in LA, they probably don't do that. But like, it is a thing that it is an insecurity problem right. that we have, but I do think some of the people that are coming up and out of Chicago, they do, I don't know, they have it too. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe it's unnecessary, but we definitely see it happening, and we love that they're doing it.
Definitely.
And I think it's a good thing. I was just going to mention, like, in terms of films, Kartemkin Films.
Yeah.
It's their 50th anniversary. And if we're going to, and we keep thinking about feature films in Chicago, why don't they make more? The reality is Kartemkin Films and Steve James and Gordon Quinn and these guys, Billy Siegel and all these guys and women, all right, like Xana Randa. They have been making documentaries here, and Chicago is on the map about that.
Yeah.
And so there's a number of different, you know, documentary filmmakers here yeah. out of Chicago. And we are just, I don't know, it's just that it's another area of Chicago that we really need to be thankful for.
Yeah, and we need to kind of sing their praises a lot more. I think there's a lot of times people are aware of an artist or aware of a like a subgenre that lives here, that's based out of here, that like so much is happening around that particular subgenre or effort that we don't necessarily, the rest of the world doesn't necessarily know.
Kartemkin changed the world in terms of documentaries, and
definitely.
Hoop Dreams in particular.
Yeah, definitely.
That is a Chicago-based film.
Yeah.
And that like changed the world
it
in terms of
did.
How documentaries can be presented.
We're talking all about cultural blind spots and touching on quite a bit of the things happening right here in our own backyard in this fine city. So we're gonna take a little bit of a break. We're gonna get you to news with David Jennings. We're gonna come back and we're gonna continue this conversation all about movies, books, music, artists, all those great things that are happening right here in our city that should be on our radar. Some of them are not yet, but they will be soon here on 720 WGN.
Live from the biggest small town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio, well, Radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor any of my folk. If I had to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for spending your Saturday with us. That, of course, was the iconic Gone with the Wind. And, you know, something I was thinking about a little bit earlier as we think about cultural blind spots, as we think about movies, and it's very interesting that, if, you know, you think about the movie that was made to tell the story of Gone with the Wind in 1937 or 8?
39.
Right?
39, yeah.
Imagine how different that movie would be right now. It would be made so differently. So there's kind of like two steps to it, right? There's a movie made a very long time ago, but it's about a period even longer ago. So yeah, you have kind of these two layers of cultural moments on top of it. But if you think about the way you would tell that story now, it would be so very different.
Well, you know, there were still Civil War veterans living. They actually went to the premiere. And what was interesting about that last scene, you know, right before she says that speech, she gags on a radish or something. Well, Vivian Leigh could not make the proper guttural sounds. So Olivia de Havilland stepped in and did that vocal inflection.
It was Melly in that film. Yes. How interesting.
Yes.
We are talking with Pat McDonald. He's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and FilmAutonomy.com. Tim Tutton, who is the owner of The Hideout, excellent music venue here in Chicago. And Craig Kingston, sorry about that, literature teacher and theater director at Crystal Lake Central High School. We're talking about those cultural blind spots, those big, big famous movies and bands and books and all those things that we know we're supposed to read or we should have read at some point, but maybe we didn't, and maybe we can confess our sins tonight. 312-981-7200 if you have a cultural blind spot that you would like to talk about or confess or suggest. Maybe there's one of those things, that there's a movie you really, 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 really love and you want to tell the rest of us about it. Let's do that. Let's totally do that. Well, so I want to shift a bit and talk about writing, because we've been talking a lot about music. But I think at the end of the last hour, we were starting to talk about how these genres really flow together in Chicago. It is very, very community driven here in a way that we don't see so much on the coast. I feel like it's a little more competitive, you know, when we think about writers and actors and filmmakers and musicians. I hear war stories of it being very, very competitive on the coast, particularly in New York for writers. But I feel like, and Craig, I'll turn this one to you, but I feel like when my book came out in 2006, what I was expecting to happen was a lot of competition and I would be the new kid on the block. But in fact, very loving, cool, wonderful people started inviting me to readings and doing stuff, and different genres of writers were getting together to do really interesting events. And they were in really interesting places. Like, they were in bars. They were in, they were in music venues. I've done several readings at The Hideout, which is this great, great music venue. Sometimes there's a band on stage in the middle of it. I mean, I went to one where there's a piano player who's taking elements of the story I read and writing a song as I'm going.
Shame That Tune, Abraham Levinson, Brian Costello.
Yeah, that was the one. It was really, really fun, and it was very great. So, you know, there's all these great literary events happening, and yet there's this very communal feel that I get the sense has been around long before any of us were with writers in Chicago. What is your take on that, Craig?
Well, yeah, I do think that it goes way back, especially when you think about like Ernest Hemingway, starting way back then, even though, and F. Scott Fitzgerald and all the early writers. And like you said earlier, you talked about how they tended to move away. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes you would find infrequent references back to the city. And I think now there is definitely more of a communal environment. I don't live in the city proper, mm-hmm. so I'm not
Chicagoland, one might say.
Yeah, there's out in the suburbs, we do have, of course, all kinds of events. We have all kinds of readings and obviously.
There, I mean, really, at least one every single night of the week, there's something cool going on. And so I have to ask you this because I think a lot of our the things that are our cultural blind spots start around the time when your students meet you, right? I think a lot of the music that we identify with happens high school and college age, and we hang on to that music because it at the time when you're like, ooh, my parents don't get me, but this guy does on the radio. I get this. This band gets me. These words get me. This book gets me. This movie gets me. Whatever it is, and so. I think the teenage experience is despite social media and things like that, it makes it a little bit different and more public, but it's still an awkward time for all of us, no matter when you were a teenager. But do you get the sense that there's any shift in because we have so much information, we have access to so much literature and so much media now, do you get the sense that there's a shift in your students, your literature students, as you get them, in what they consume, what they have a taste for, what resonates with them?
Well, I think social media plays an interesting role because I think it reinforces sometimes and limits, kind of often gives students a tunnel vision where they are paying attention to what they already pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And so some of the bigger challenges is forcing kids outside of their comfort zone, outside of what they already know. Some of the things that we try to do is challenge them, forcing them to read non-Western writers like Khaled Hosseini with The Kite Runner,
yeah,
and the Mountain Echoed. Things that are really forcing kids to see the world globally and not just in their limited community, among their friends, among their peers, in their high school. Patrick was talking about earlier when we were in the green room, he was talking about how when he was in high school, school felt like that microcosm, that felt like the world. And I think sometimes it's our responsibility to challenge them to move outside of that world.
Sure. I think, you know, as you were talking about more global literature and as you're pushing students to expand more in that way, I'm reminded of Chimamanda Adichie's TED Talk about the danger of the single story. That's one I reference a lot, I think about a lot, because it's so powerful as she's talking about, there's the dominant narrative around what it means to be from Africa, in her case, when she said, but I was actually quite wealthy, and then I arrived in the United States, my roommate didn't understand that that was possible. And she was talking about seeing literature as a young girl that was written about British kids. And so she said there was snow, there was, you know, these foods that I had never seen. There were these things happening that weren't part of my world. And so I thought that was the dominant narrative. And I think that's an interesting thing to explore when we think about, especially I think movies and books really, because there's, I think music is more discoverable than anything right now. It's highly discoverable, but I think it's a little bit less so with books and movies to discover outside of the main genre or out of the main, what the majority says. Here is the pantheon of classics stuff, and here's what you must know and discover, and here are the pillars you must hit. I think it's it might be a little bit harder to get on the edges of that, and which then kind of starts to beg the question of who sets that.
Right, right. You know? Exactly. That goes back to like E.D. Hirsch and the cultural literacy argument from the 1980s and 90s. And honestly, I think the discussion about the list is probably more important than the list itself. In creating that list and explaining, arguing with other teachers, other educators, you come to realize, I think, more about yourself. And more about, other people's biases, mm-hmm, as well as what they prefer, preferences, mm-hmm, and kind of their global perspective as well.
Right. I mean, I remember this, I feel like it was just a few years ago when everybody was talking about Tom Sawyer, of should that still be taught in a school? It has some language now that is really offensive, but at the time it wasn't. And so, what do? Do we restrict this because it has this language in it? Or do we say, here is a snapshot of a time that is important for students to understand, for just to have a historical perspective on that, which I think is really interesting. But you probably run into that quite a bit with a lot of different works, probably, Craig, you probably see that in books as much as Pat, you see that in movies that are told in so many, interesting ways. Like we were talking about Gone with the Wind. Like if you start talking about the idea of, right, say, like slavery, you've got Amistad, right, you've got Roots, you've got Gone with the Wind. Like you have all of these stories about a central theme there, but told in so many different ways, right?
Well, you picked up, too, on you were talking about the cultural pantheon, mm-hmm. you know. And with the technological, with the digital age, with the rise of the internet, it just, the borders are gone. You know, we could, in the 80s, we could put out a list of the 100 greatest books and people would say, okay, I've got this list. And now you can go on the internet and you can find 10 websites with the 100 greatest books and they're all different. Mm-hmm. So what the internet has done is expanded our possibilities with the cultural pantheon in movies or books. But it's also as a culture, we don't have that thing that we're all gathered around. Like going back to what you were talking about in high school, there was three networks when I was growing up. So then, you know, if the moon landing happens, everybody's watching it. Now, if the moon landing happened today, you know, somebody would be watching the Animal Planet or HBO or whatever. They all wouldn't necessarily be watching the moon landing. So
that is a very interesting point. And I was just talking with someone about this. Like, speaking of a cultural blind spot, I feel like a lot of young people right now consuming media, the cultural blind spot they have is gathering around a live event.
Right.
Right. Because the last time this really hit home when I was watching Nick Willenda walk across the Grand Canyon, and I was watching social media and all these people were watching this live event to see if this man was going to plummet to his death, because who in the world would walk across the Grand Canyon and then across Chicago? Right. Yeah. And I was like, you know what? This is the first time some people have gathered around outside of like the Super Bowl.
Right.
Right. People are not gathering around to watch an event, whereas before, we remember watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and we remember where we were when, you know, major tragic events happened. But we also remember, you know, major works were screened. Like, my grandfather's always talking about, like, the Orwell broadcast, like, you know, remembering that so clearly, and that kind of like a moment, right? And so I think that's a really interesting thing to think about, that we don't, the blind spot may not be the product. It might be the medium and the delivery and the experience around experiencing it. All right. We're talking about cultural blind spots and all of the many forms that they take. We have an esteemed panel of experts here with us. We're talking with Tim Tutton, Pat McDonald, and Craig Kingston. We're going to take a little break and we'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
You want to do something fun? You want to go to Taco Bell?
I can't go to Taco Bell. I'm on an all-carb diet. God, Karen, you are so stupid.
Regina, wait. Talk to me.
Nobody understands me.
Out of bed at the crack of noon. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. We're talking all about cultural blind spots tonight. We are going down some rabbit holes because there's so much to this. There is really so much to this. I wish we could spend hours talking about this topic because it is so interesting and there's so much to it. If you have a comment, 312-981-7200, or you can send me a tweet. I'm at Amy Guth on Twitter and on Facebook. You can find me there too. We can keep this conversation going all week long, of course. I have an esteemed panel of guests here with me tonight. Tim Tutton is the owner of The Hideout, a wonderful music venue right here in Chicago. Pat McDonald is a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and FilmAutonomy.com. And Craig Kingston is a literature teacher and theater director at Crystal Lake Central High School. So we have many, many experts in the room right now, lots of wonderful points of view. But, you know, right before the break, Craig, we started to talk about the list of, the list of knowledge, the list of the essential things that every American must know, and beginning to kind of talk about who decides that, who gets to say that. And you started to make a point on the break, and I stopped you because I really wanted to make that on the air and have this conversation really about a shift that you're seeing educationally, and less about the education itself, but more about the emphasis.
Yeah, in education right now, there's an emphasis, especially with Park, an emphasis away from like the content and more towards skills. So it's less dependent on what kids are specifically reading, and instead more important what they do with that reading. So using text to help support an argument, to ways to research, ways to use intertextual arguments. And so that list of like what everybody should read is becoming a little thinner, mm-hmm. At least on the high school level, I think. There are still, and we still want to have that common experience of a book or something that the whole class can talk about. But there's movement towards, especially with me, one of the groups that I teach is struggling readers, freshmen struggling readers. So one of the things that you want to do is give them choice and allow them to pursue. So and that's happening a lot. It came from the middle school levels, the literature circles and book clubs, book circles, things like that, and giving students an opportunity to explore, find books that are, number one, maybe closer to their own reading level, because not all kids are reading at the same level. Number two, to get kids to pursue their own interests. There's a difference between a Nicholas Sparks, for example, and some guys just don't want to read that, and mm-hmm. and a Dan Brown book or something
sure.
like that.
Sure. Well, I mean, I do think that's really interesting that the idea of you know, this textural argument that, you know, using pieces, you know, slicing up literature to do things. Because the first thing that I think of when you say that is anytime I share a very compelling read, usually an op-ed or something like that, some kind of big think piece, when I share it on Facebook, I will usually say, hey, don't internet read this, read it.
Right.
Like, read the whole thing. Don't internet read, which means just kind of like read a couple sentences and then go. And I have noticed another alarming trend, and that is, if you say, oh, did you read that piece in the New York Times this week about so-and-so? Yeah, I saw that. Okay, I didn't ask you if you saw it. I asked you if you read it. And I think that's a thing that we're kind of shifting to, that people the idea of having an awareness of something equals reading it. And that may be a result, you know, part of I don't want to say symptom, but, you know, maybe kind of an offshoot of what you're describing.
Oh, definitely. Especially with struggling readers, getting them to, we call it close read. Mm-hmm. And even on the AP level, I mean, that's what the AP test is all about, breaking down challenging text on a very fine, minute level.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
And then comparatively, again, going back to my high school experience, they always made everybody read the same thing. And I think they turned off a lot of readers back then, because some of us could pick it up and go on and be readers. I'm just glad that they're parsing it that way, because if you create a reader, you're going to create somebody who is going to expand their perspective, essentially.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Truly. All right, we're talking all about cultural blind spots tonight. We're going to take a little break, get you to news. When we come back, we're going to be talking all about the movies, the music, the books, the artists, all those things that maybe you didn't quite grab the way you were supposed to, or maybe something you really, really grabbed onto that maybe you feel like you might be the only one that loves that piece of art in the way that you do. So give us a call, 312-981-7200, and let's talk all about it. We'll be back in just a bit on 720 WGN.
What do you want to know?
Well, Mr. Bernstein, we thought maybe if we could find out what he meant by his last words as he was dying.
That rosebud, huh? Maybe some girl. There were a lot of them back in the early days.
It's hardly likely, Mr. Bernstein, that Mr. Kane could have met some girl casually and then 50 years later on his deathbed.
Well, you're pretty young, Mr. Thompson. A fellow will remember a lot of things you wouldn't think he'd remember.
720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for spending your evening with us. We are talking all about cultural blind spots this evening, and that is the books, the music, the movies, the artists, the albums, all those things that you should have gotten around to, says who, but you should have nonetheless, and just haven't done it. Or that you are the possessor of knowledge of this cool indie thing that you feel like not enough people know about and love. All of those things all contribute to this conversation all about cultural blind spots. And so we're here with Tim Tutton, who is the owner of the Hideout Music Venue here in Chicago, Pat McDonald, who's a film critic at HollywoodChicago.com and FilmAutonomy.com, and Craig Kingston, who teaches literature and directs theater at Crystal Lake Central High School. So we were talking right before the break, we were talking about this idea and this notion of says who, of who says, who picks that pantheon of and decides what's classic and what is classic literature, and Craig was talking a bit about how that's shifting in education, and it's less about what's about consuming that content and more about how it's consumed and empowering the students to do things with that. And so I want to shift a little bit to movies and turn this to you a bit, Pat. As we think about that, I mean, that's really been something that's very up right now because in the last, I mean, just a few months ago, we saw the Oscars So White thing kind of pop out and suddenly people are calling, you know, calling foul on things that have gone on for a very long time. I think just this week there was, or in the last 2 weeks, I suppose, Scarlett Johansson being in Ghost in the Shell, there was this information out that perhaps through the magic of CGI, she was going to be made to look Asian. And there was great outcry. I immediately think of like Western flicks and things like that. There was a time when all you know, actor, there wasn't a really, there weren't actors of color being cast per se. It was usually a white person playing a person of color. And that was just the standard then. And I think it's very interesting how that kind of shift has happened. What other shifts like that are you seeing around film right now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I was a little distracted by the Citizen Kane clip coming in because I was thinking that it just had its 75th anniversary on May 1st, and then it premiered in Chicago on May 6th. So just a little fact there.
Yeah, Orson Welles' Chicago connection.
You know what I say on the tour bus, you know, because constantly people ask, well, what's your favorite movie and what's the greatest movie of all time and this and that and the other thing. And I always say, you know, I'll tell you the greatest movie of all time, whatever your favorite movie is. And I think that kind of tells us about the access that people have had to motion pictures in the last generation. You know, we were talking about how we began to love movies, and it was on The Late Show. And that was the only way we could get to a movie, was to watch it on The Late Show. And I was in the Chicago market. I grew up in Michigan City, Indiana. And we were very, very lucky because the Chicago market really respected film on television. So we got to see and be exposed to a lot of stuff even before I got to college and started studying film. Well, now everybody has access to film at a touch of a button. And I think when you asked what is changing, I think what people's tastes are changing. They don't necessarily have a common aspect about what films are the greatest anymore. They have their top 10 favorites, and that's the greatest. And now with YouTube and all other outlets, you can go in and even see even weirder stuff. And it doesn't necessarily have to be 90 minutes. It can be 10 minutes or 5 minutes. So what is changing is our attention spans. And what is changing is our tastes because of our access to the digital medium. So I think that's the biggest change when you ask.
I'll say, you know, I like the old school stuff where they say you need to see Citizen Kane. You need to see, you know, A Streetcar Named Desire or whatever. And I think that as high school teachers, I was a high school teacher for 20 years too. And so we used to require books for the kids to read. And I can remember when I was in high school, we're talking about books. You know, I had to read A Tale of Two Cities, I had to read A Farewell to Arms, and I had to read 1984. And like an idiot high school kid in the 70s, I really did not read them deeply. I read them superficially, and I wrote the kind of papers that I thought my teacher wanted to hear. And after I got out of college, which coincidentally was 1984, I read 1984 by George Orwell, and my mind was blown that my teacher actually gave me a book that was as radical as that, you know? Mm. And then I read A Tale of Two Cities again. I reread it, and I was really embarrassed. And luckily, I became a high school teacher, went back to Glenbrook. I was at Glenbrook South, but my teacher friend was at Glenbrook North, and I was like, I'm really sorry. And it helped me as a high school teacher to realize that teenagers space out a lot of stuff that we're teaching them. Later on, it might come back to them. So when I was a high school teacher, I had kids that would just, when I'd be talking about the classical canon or whatever, listen to Neil Young or Rolling Stones or whatever. And I remember students telling me, do you know who NWA is? You don't. Right. Do you know who Wu-Tang Clan is? I mean, I remember teaching, and I taught from 1986 to 2005. That was my period as a classroom teacher. And I remember the whole school was empty, all right, at one point in like the late 80s. And I was like, what is going on? And they were like, Wu-Tang's second album is coming out here in Chicago. And so that was a really historic seminal event. And I don't know, but I think about just coincidentally is like Spike Lee. with Chirac. Whether you like that movie, hate that movie, that's a classic example of what teachers and what adults are supposed to do. As teachers, we tell kids, you really need to read this book. You really need to see this movie. You really need to understand these artists. And we hopefully are culturally diverse and we understand this multifaceted ideas. It isn't just Eurocentric. Mm-hmm. But the thing is that we also try to connect something from the classics into the contemporary situation. And by Spike Lee taking an Aristophanes story mm-hmm. and then doing Chirac, and whatever you feel about the movie, he was really doing that, saying like, okay, young bloods, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a 2,000-year-old story. I'm going to position it in Chicago, of all places, on the South Side, and give you a new interpretation of it. And I think that that is that's an important thing, but it's great to start the conversation with the, especially the crazy thing about America is that we're a youth culture and we think the kids are so smart. We thought we were so smart. They are smart. They're creative, but they really are looking to adults.